So there's six of them that we're talking about.
Let's call this meeting of the State Lands Commission to order. All of the representatives of the commission are present. I'm Cindy Ehrenberg, and I'm Deputy Controller for the Environment to State Controller John Chung. I'm joined by Lieutenant Governor Abel Maldonado and Cynthia Bryant, who represents the Department of Finance. For the benefit of those in the audience, the State Lands Commission administers property zoned by the state as well as its mineral interests. Today, we will hear proposals concerning the leasing and management of these properties. The first item of business is the minutes from the last meeting. May I have a motion to approve the minutes? Do we have a second? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
The minutes are approved unanimously. The next order of business is the executive officer's report. Mr. Thayer, may we have your report?
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the commission. I'd like to devote the executive officer's report to a review of the audit, which will be conducted on the State Lands Commission. We've provided a lot of material to the commissioner's offices, but we're in a public forum here, and I think it's important to discuss what's happened and what will happen in the future and be available to answer questions should the commissioners have any on the whole process. So this will take several minutes, and we've distributed copies of several different pieces of information to the commissioners that I'll refer to. There's an initial letter from Senator Cogdill. There's a staff response which was mailed to the audit committee. And then finally, a revenue history for the State Lands Commission. So to review this, by way of background, on July 21st, Senator Cogdill released a letter which he had sent to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, on which he serves as a member. It raised concerns about whether the rents at the State Lands Commission were being kept current, and the particular concerns that were expressed in the letter were over the effect of lease holdovers, whether or not the rent reviews were timely, a pipeline rental formula, and the negotiation results for several specific leases. I want to start by saying that staff, and we believe the commission, operates from the premise that the public should obtain fair market rent for the public's lands. And generally, we think, and the regulations provide, that the annual rent should be 9% of the appraised value of the land. You know, and that formula is pretty good because it moves with inflation. So as property becomes valued higher, our rents go up. Each lease is individually negotiated, and sometimes particular circumstances can cause different results. As I say, I've provided you copies of the commission's revenue history clear back to 1938, which is when the commission was established, and I'm sorry for the fine print there. But Senator Cogdill's letter focuses really on the sixth column over from the left, the one entitled Surface Rentals. These are the rents that are charged for things like marine terminals or other kinds of development that are located generally on dry land or marinas on wet property. But it's meant to be differentiated from oil revenues. And as you can see, the surface rentals are a fairly small portion of our overall revenue total, which is almost to the end on the right-hand side as the column of the total revenues. So our cumulative total through last year was about $8.8 billion, and of that, the surface rentals was about $200 million. I think you can also see by looking at this column that the annual revenues from the surface rentals, when you look at the second page there in particular, has steadily climbed. We were down there a little over $5 million just 15 years ago in 1994-95. This has climbed to what's really around $12 to $13 million right now. The $20 million, which is shown for 2008-09, is an anomaly, and we don't want to claim a lot of credit for that because it includes back rent that was paid by Chevron for the Richmond Long Wharf when we renegotiated a lease there. But we're at about $12 or $13 million right now. And those increases come in part because of new leases, where we steadily have more leases as we progress. But most of that increase comes from things the staff is doing to increase the revenue to the state. So we act on the five-year rent reviews, which are part of every lease, every rent-paying lease. And there are a bunch of those in this calendar, this agenda. If you look through it, you'll see there are a lot of them where we're raising the rent. and they show up in every agenda. Other things that contribute to the amount going up are the annual consumer price index adjuster that we've started putting into the leases just in the last 10 years, with the idea that instead of waiting for the five-year rent review, we can adjust annually the rents to keep them current. And then finally, of course, the rent adjustments that occur when we renew a lease. Commission staff, in response to the letter from the senator, prepared a written response, which went to the committee, and of course, copies were given to the commissioners. The response was intended to provide some factual background, correct a couple of mistakes in the senator's letter, and suggest improvements that the commission could make in response to the concerns raised by the senator. And of course, notwithstanding that response, the committee did approve the audit, and we expect that audit will start next month and take somewhere around five months. And of course, we will cooperate fully with the audit. As we've already gotten a letter from the Auditor General's Chief Counsel asking us to notify staff not to delete material unless it was in the normal course of business. And we've sent an email around to staff to make sure that's going to be followed. We'll return to the Commission when that audit is done and discuss what changes, if any, are suggested in that audit, how we should react. However, in the interim, I think it's important that we both can and should move forward with the changes that we've already believe are appropriate based on the senator's first letter. And I'd like to go over those. There are four of them. Three were mentioned in our response, and we've added one more. The first one would be put a requirement in all future leases that the applicant would have to apply for a renewal 2 years before the lease would expire. That would start the whole process that much sooner if there's an environmental review that's needed, and that's one of the reasons the oil terminal leases have gone into holdover frequently, where we want to see an EIR for that because of the risk of oil spill. And that's not settled law, and the oil companies have resisted that at times, and it's taken a while to get that done. But I think starting 2 years before the lease expires will get us going sooner, and we can resolve these issues sooner. We developed this option actually earlier this year, where we were doing an internal review of the holdovers and looking for ways to prevent them. The second recommendation would be if a lease is in holdover, we should conduct rent reviews to make sure that even if we're under the old lease, we're charging current market rents. We'd already started to do that. In fact, for the El Segundo Marine Terminal lease, which is in holdover, we brought a rent review to the commission last year. It wasn't the new lease, but it brought them up to the current rent, and there also we'll be bringing an agreement for them to pay back rent so that during the holdover period, the rents will be raised even higher than they've been paying right now. But we're going to do that on a regular basis. The center took note of a pipeline rent formula that's in our regulations that was established last in 1980. It provides that the commission will charge rent for pipelines of 2 cents per diameter inch per lineal foot. So the idea is, you know, we're going to charge based on the length of the pipeline and also the width of the pipeline. We agree that 1980 is a long time, and that formula should be updated, and we'll be bringing back an updated formula for the commission to approve, and we have to go through the regulatory process to do that. However, the senator's letter doesn't take note of the fact that when you look at our regulations, we have two methods of calculating rent for pipelines, and one of them is the one that he highlighted, but the other one is just our standard 9% of appraised value. Charged based on the right-of-way used by the pipeline. That does generate a current market rent, and we've been using that right along. So the effect of not updating that 1980s formula does take away one tool we have for calculating rent, but it doesn't limit us from collecting market rate rents, and that's something that's been lost in the discussion. We would also probably include a CPI inflator for whatever we set, because whatever we set will be out of date a year later, so we need to do something. Rather than coming back to the commission every year with a new regulatory change, let's put something in there so it'll automatically adjust. And finally, the last point is that we're going to continue to pursue adding auditor positions during the budget process. We've attempted to do that the last 4 or 5 years. We have one auditor. At one time, we had four. The one auditor is able to do about 30, well, he did 32 audits last year. So we have some limitations there. We try and, of course, focus that resource on the leases that pay the most money. But if we had more auditors, we could do a better job. So in terms of how to implement all this, staff is currently working on an internal process outline, which will implement the non-regulatory aspects of these regulations, which are all of them except for the 8 cent per, the pipeline formula. This outline will include other intermediate deadlines and staff review protocols. The outline will guide staff. It'll be an internal working document that will guide us in the future. We hope to have that finalized next month, and we'll certainly send copies to the commissioners. If you have any comments, we'd be eager to hear them. But the point is, we want to start doing this now before the audit's done. The new pipeline formula, because it has to be done through the regulatory process, will take longer. It'll probably take us a couple of months to make sure we get the right figure. We're going to use our appraiser for that. We'll probably look at what other states are charging, what the feds are charging, what private landowners are charging to come up with an amount which is reasonable. And then I'm told it takes 6 to 10 months to go through the OAL requirements, sometimes longer if we get a lot of negative comments, that kind of thing. But we're going to start that process, but it won't be done until next year. And obviously, even though we're starting this now, there may be additional things that the auditor recommends, and of course, we'll look at those with the commission when that happens. So that's where we are on this. I wanted to make sure the commission was up to date on the whole process, not only how the auditor is working, but in terms of how staff is responding to that on your behalf. And I'd be happy to respond if the commissioners have any questions.
Here. I just wanted to make a comment that there's no secret. The State Lands Commission is a public trust, and I just hope that in these next couple of weeks or months that we expedite the process to get all the information to JLAC. And, it's a review, and if we've done a good job, then we're going to get a good review. If we have not, then there's going to be a bad review. And I just hope that we're up front immediately on all that they ask. And I think that shows that the State Lands Commission has been doing their job. Now, on all these other issues that Senator Cogdill has asked, I'm sure if staff does that on the other ones, we can get them to us sooner rather than later, so we can move on and get this off on top of the State Lands Commission.
Thank you. We'll do that. Okay, well, that completes the executive officer's report.
Do you want to talk about any enforcement items?
No, they're all kind of percolating along, much okay. As they were last time when we discussed. We have two new ones on the regular calendar today, but the others are still works in progress.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Thayer. The next item of business is the consent calendar. What items have been removed from the consent calendar, Mr. Thayer?
Item 37 will be removed because there's some discussion about making the lease a little bigger, and we'll hear that at a future meeting. Item 25, we thought there this issue had been worked out. However, there's a speaker slip in from the lessee, and so we'll remove 25 from the consent calendar and hear that at the end of the meeting. I'd also note that just as a technical clarification, item 31 has an exhibit that shows a pier down, or not a pier, an outfall down at the El Segundo facility, and it depicts it much shorter than it actually is. The length is longer. However, the lease is calculated on the correct area, that's the larger area. And then finally, item 54, which is I thought I'd mention now, is on the regular calendar, but it's being removed because both the notice and the staff report were based on an agreed upon, or at least which we'd hoped was going to be agreed upon both by commission staff and by the Seacliff Colony Association. The association did not agree with that lease ultimately, and so that has to be removed. Just for your information, we have a number of speaker slips from them. They would like to address the commission in the public comment period. They have a counter proposal, and we're likely to bring that back in October when we've had a chance to review it. But the notice wouldn't allow us to hear that at this commission meeting. So 25 and 37 are removed from the consent calendar at this point.
Thank you. I also have a speaker slip here for item 44, Janice Dunn. Ms. Dunn, are you here? It looks like this item is probably going to go through. Do you still want to speak on it at the end of the meeting? Because we can remove it from the consent calendar, or we can just let it go through. Okay, great. So is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak on an item that is still on the consent calendar? Okay, seeing none, let's take the remaining group of consent items up for a single vote. Do I have a motion? We have a motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
The consent calendar is approved. Let's move on to the next item. I think we've got an informational report from Lieutenant Governor, who's requested an opportunity to address the commission about his recent trip to the Gulf of Mexico.
First of all, thank you for that. And I just wanted to give a brief report to the commissioners, obviously, on what I did when I went over to the Gulf. To me, it was a trip on July 26th that I didn't know what to expect, but obviously was very excited about going to this area to see what has happened under the circumstances that they were in with connection to what we have here in California. First of all, I learned that no one could tell me how many offshore platforms were in the Gulf of Mexico. Some people said 3,100, some people said 5,400, some people said 2,800. I came away that there's a hell of a lot of oil platforms off the coast of Louisiana. And I think that's what was very, very important. In California, we have 27. I also came away that the ones in Louisiana are very, very high pressure, and several of them are very, very deep, which are the ones that created the problem. In California, we're not as deep. We're very shallow wells. But I can tell you that when I first arrived in Houma, Louisiana, I first went to the Incident Command Center, and by that, there was three Incident Command Centers, one in Houma, one in Houston, and one in Florida. And they were all somewhat mirrored after the what we do here when we have a fire with CAL FIRE. So we had some retired CAL FIRE folks there that were going through the process of telling them how we do it in California. So I was happy to see that. Also, to see a lot of environmental folks from California, from UC Davis, doctors on the wildlife that were there. They would wink an eye at me and say, "We're so far ahead of what they're doing here," which I thought made me feel very, very good. But nevertheless, what had happened was so, so big, and no one would know what the ramifications would be down the road. Through that process, I had the opportunity to fly out over the Deep Horizon well. And as you can see, that they call that sheen toward the area. I arrived 10 days after they had capped it. There was still a leak, but we could still see some remnants. And through that process, I got to learn a little bit about boom, which is a material that that holds and contains oil after there's a spill to keep it from coming to mainland and so forth, or different protected areas. There was about 836 miles of boom laid out there. And I don't remember the name, but there was a hurricane that came in right after that, and it displaced about 650 miles of boom, and they had to go back in places. So it was amazing to see all these fishermen and everybody coming together to try to place that. And then obviously then we arrived to the incident area, which, you know, it was kind of sobering to see what had gone out there. And what you see there on the top was a big floating platform, which was a relief well. And here you have a group of folks who are drilling a relief well. First of all, they go through about 5,000 feet of water, and then there's no drilling there, obviously. But once they get to the base of it at 5,000 feet, which is a mile, they drill about another 15,000 to 16,000 feet into the ground, ocean bottom. And then they curve it at the bottom, and they have to hit about a 7 and 5 inch pipe, which really is amazing. And the guy that was doing that said he's never missed. And it just goes to show you the technology. And they did one on the right side, and they did one on the left side. And I didn't realize how they were trying to cap it, but the goal was to drill into that pipe and load it up with mud and cement and load it up so much that as it filled up, the pressure of it eventually would stop the well from leaking. And obviously they did it. And what was really interesting, and it hurt a lot, was to see in the middle of it, you can see there that ship in the middle, that's where Deep Horizons was. That platform sunk all the way to the ground. But there was, I think, about 160 people working on the platform. 11 died. It's really a miracle that more people didn't die. But they jumped off and they went to ships that were in the area. And I can tell you that's for that. It was kind of got teary-eyed when I saw that. But through that process, there was a couple of things that I take away from that process, and I hope that California can implement here. Number one, going through this process, looking at what we call a oil response plan. Currently, we have a 7-day response plan in California. The Gulf had a 7-day response plan in California. And I think it's important that maybe this commission look at maybe implementing or looking at what the federal government is now doing and maybe implementing a 30-day response plan from the 27 oil leases that we have off the coast. Not saying that they're going to blow up like they did out there, but just to be prepared. I represent coastal California, and I must tell you that in my district, in my former district, the lifeblood was tourism and, of course, the protection of the coast. And I just think we need to be on par because the whole coast of California is what brings a lot of tourism to this great state, and maybe looking at a 30-day response plan from the folks that have leases. And also what I learned, I had an opportunity to sit down with our colleagues in Louisiana, state lands folks, and I asked them about their plans. Obviously, the lobbying core is a lot different in Louisiana. When you have 5,000 wells compared to 27 wells, it just goes to show you the influence that's in Louisiana. They explained that to me. Through that process, I was kind of surprised to hear from them that this could have been prevented. However, they were waiting to see what the reports were going to be after a 30 or 40 day or 6-month process of how this happened. Some folks said that there was just mistakes made, and they will be getting to the bottom of that. They did mention that some of the mistakes were probably tied to money, but they weren't sure about that. They wanted to get to the bottom of that. So I'm looking forward to seeing what's going to happen with that. One thing that they are going to be implementing, and it's something that I think we ought to maybe take a look at it, I oppose offshore oil drilling. I've always have. So I don't see any wells popping up on our California coastline, but we do have property that's off the California coast that's in the federal hands. I think we need to look at having a third-party verification if that process ever goes through again. That's something they're going to be doing, and I think it's important as it moves forward for them that when they start the process of drilling, there is a third-party verification. They're watching what they're doing so there isn't any shortcuts. I'll repeat myself. When you have 4,000 to 5,000 wells in the Gulf, they're going to continue to drill, and that's something they're looking at. Us is totally different, but I think it's something that we ought to look to if something was to change in the future. I just think just to synthesize of what the outcome of the whole trip was is that the people of Louisiana were hit hard by Katrina. And many businesses said to me, we were so happy when we won the Super Bowl, and it was bringing back the morale in the city that was hit so hard by Katrina. And to have this hit, a lot of the people says, what's next for us? And I'm hoping that there's nothing next for them. Maybe they can win a Super Bowl again. I don't know. But all I can say is that their tourism was somewhat hit. We visited some hotels. We visited a bed and breakfast that's very popular there in Louisiana. And I asked them how was it. And it was kind of a repeat of, it's the lifeblood. Tourism is the lifeblood of Louisiana. But so is offshore oil. How do we keep them together? And third but not least, the fishing industry. And we have that here too. I mean, we have the fishing industry, we have tourism, and we have oil wells. So I think those two things that I'm looking at recommending is something that this commission ought to look at. I'm not stuck on the language. I think I can be open-minded and reasonable, but it's something that coming back from the trip brings it up. I am going to have a meeting with some of the folks that do have platform leases out here. I'd like to see their plans on oil spill prevention. And, you know, we heard a lot of rumors of what the plans were in Louisiana. Some of them were what we heard, but all in all, people were doing their best to clean this place up. So, and just a shout out to the state employees of California. They were over there working very, very hard. And, you know, we always get caught up in this notion of state employees taking a beating for pensions and all this other thing. All I can say is that they were dedicated state employees of California working very, very hard to help the people of Louisiana, whether it be in prevention, cleanup, wildlife protection. I was thoroughly, thoroughly impressed with that. And we ought to commend them for all their hard work during these difficult times. There were tours. They would show up for 10 days, leave for 10 days, come back. People were exhausted. But to see 42,000 people in action trying to clean up an oil spill was really, really amazing. And, you know, at the end of the process, I think they were somewhat organized. And I'm glad that California had input in that. So I just wanted to give the commission that briefing.
Thank you. Paul?
If I could just respond to a couple of the points that the Lieutenant Governor made. We've been in contact with the Lieutenant Governor's office on several of these two points, the third-party verification and the seven-day contingency plan. And we're looking at how we can respond to those suggestions. As I know the Lieutenant Governor knows, the contingency plans deal with how to respond to an oil spill should it occur, and those respond to regulations that are put out by the Office of Spill Prevention and Response in the Department of Fish and Game. We also look at those plans, but we don't have the same kind of review authority over them. But we're partners really with OSPR, and we'll be working with OSPR on what would work best, and we can certainly convey the Lieutenant Governor's concerns, although I know he's doing that personally as well. On third-party verification, we're looking at that as well. We think that it may be, and we have a report coming up later in this agenda about what we can do to better or improve our programs, the State Lands Commission programs. And looking at the third-party verification issue, we think the problem in the Gulf might very well have been that you had all the wells and the leases that the Lieutenant Governor refers to. And I understand that the MMS standing and our staffing in the Gulf is the same as it is for the Pacific. And as we know, the Pacific is a fraction of the activity that you have in the Gulf. And so a lot of the oil companies in the Gulf were self-reporting and self-monitoring. And so in that circumstance, there wasn't MMS staff to go out there and do their verification. And in that circumstance, third-party verification makes a lot of sense. Because we have so many fewer wells and fewer platforms and don't have new leases going, our staff is able, along with the Department of Conservation, that also has a regulatory role over the safety equipment on wells throughout California, including offshore, is able to go out there, and when wells are drilled, they're so infrequent these days, we're out there witnessing it and, in effect, providing perhaps the equivalent of that. But we need to look further into that to see what's meant by third-party verification. Are we really accomplishing the same thing, or do we need to do something more about it?
Thank you.
And we'll do that.
Thank you. Item 48 is a report regarding the Bolsa Chica Restoration Project. Jim Trout is here to give the report.
Thank you. I'll only take a couple of minutes. The commission staff has been involved in the restoration and saving of the Bolsa Chica lowland since 1970 when the tidal issues first came up. This was a proposed site of some 5,800 dwelling units as Orange County proposed to expand significantly in the residential area. In 2004, the commission, along with several other state and federal agencies, started on the physical restoration of the Bolsa Chica area. And this is just a quick update on what's happened so far. Thank you. And I guess I don't know what I'm doing here. Okay, now This is what it looked like in 2004, and this is an active oil field with about 300 to 400 wells, and they're spaced throughout this whole area, and it's been a producing oil field since 1950. Here's what it looks like now. The oil wells in that area were removed. As you can see, there's ocean entrance was put in here to restore this area to the ocean, to complete marine cycling. And then we're monitoring the progress. We're trying to determine how successful the area has been. So this is the second annual report, and these are the areas that are involved. This is the full tidal area that you saw, has full influence of the tide. This is a limited marsh area that is very restricted. These areas back here are muted tidal areas, and they receive just a portion of the daily tides. And then seasonal ponds are down here. This is a future restoration area, and this is a very active remaining oil field, although there's some wells in here. This is what we call the future full tidal area that as soon as the oil plays out, right now under oil prices, probably 25 years, we have funds set aside to also restore that to tidal influence. And this is just, I'll go through these quickly. These are some of the birds that have been there. The Savannah sparrow is a federally endangered species. The snowy plover is a threatened species that tends to nest in the area. And we're seeing excellent restoration of a fisheries nursery. For example, we have halibut here, and this is a round ray and perches and fish here. These are all young of the year. These show that the restored wetlands are a significant nursery area for Pacific fisheries. And this gives you an example of the fishes that the birds prey on mostly, although bigger fish also eat them. But these are the basic food chain for the marine birds. And this is the vegetation monitoring, just to show what's going on. The benthic monitoring, that's what's in the mud at the bottom of the lagoon. We've got scallops, we've got crab, shrimp, and sea slugs, if anybody's interested in a sea slug. And the problem with any ocean inlet is that it tends to silt up. And under natural conditions, they will totally silt up until a big winter storm comes and reopens the inlet. Now, because of all the dams and other activities, these natural occurrences are no longer there. So we have to dredge this area about every 2 years. That's where it's showing. And this was what it was 2 years ago. And then the right-hand slide is during the dredging when we got rid of most of the sand. We're just about to start another dredging episode this fall, probably in early October. And then this is what's yet to be done. We're going to monitor in year 4 to just birds and sensitive birds in the beach. In year 5, which starts in October, will be a full monitoring year. And then 6, 7, 8, and 9 will just be beach and sensitive monitoring. And then year 10, we'll have a full and final monitoring year. And at that point, we will have met all the permit requirements. And we hope that it will be as successful then as it has been up to now. So just to give you an update, Ms. Ehrenberg, I think, is the only one that's actually been there. She was there for the groundbreaking in 2004. Thank you.
Jim, we couldn't tell you about this, but we have one other part of the show that we want you to participate in if you would mind coming up on the stage. Looks like it is a surprise. Jim is probably one of the longest working staff people for the state that's ever been. He started working for the state in 1953. I was in diapers at that point, and I'm retiring now, so it kind of shows how long he's been around. He first retired, and he worked for a number of different state agencies, including the state architect's office, the Department of Finance, who's a budget analyst there working on capital outlay, and then came to the State Lands Commission in 1967. I was starting Cal at that point. He already had a career under his belt. So among the things that he worked on was obviously Bolsa Chica, and he's been doing that, what, since the 70s?
Yeah.
And it's a job that's taken a long time to get done with. There were originally, the state only owned a small portion of the eventual wetlands. The State Lands Commission helped broker a deal with the ports of LA and Long Beach where mitigation that they needed for important infrastructure projects was going to be created at Bolsa Chica, and they contributed over $100 million to the restoration there. So Bolsa Chica not only has restored wetlands, but it also has facilitated important economic development in the state. And Jim retired in 1995. And since then, he's been a retired annuitant, and thank God he's kept working on Bolsa Chica for us because nobody knows it the way he does. Now, he's not indicated when he's going to stop yet. He hasn't said, I'm done at the end of this year, this sort of thing. But some of the staff came to me several weeks ago and said, you know, he's beginning to check out. You know, he's got other things. He's training up his replacement so that there's somebody else to can handle it. He even missed one of the working group meetings, which was unheard of. He's been chair of that group for a long time. So we didn't want him to fade away like the Cheshire Cat without recognizing everything he's done for what is really one of the most important environmental resources in Southern California. Let me just say a couple words about that, too. The state now has lost 91% of the coastal wetlands in Southern California. So the 1,000 acres or so, or 1,200 acres at Bolsa Chica is a really significant portion of what's left. And the fact that we are able to bring that back from the unremediated, degraded wetlands that they have become because of the oil development and other diking and levying is really great for the state and is really a tribute to all of Jim's hard work. So in order not to let this pass unnoticed, and he may be back before us, I don't know. I don't want him to think that we're trying to kick him out the door here. It's just we want to make sure that he's recognized while he's still here. So we have a resolution here that we'd like the commission to present to honor Jim for all of his hard work. We don't have signatures on it yet, but we're going to circulate this, and everybody can we can get all the commissioners to sign it that way. And I don't know if any of the other commissioners wanted to make any comments as well.
You know what? I would like to read this excellent resolution into the record, Jim, if you don't mind. This resolution honors you, and you deserve to have it read into the record. Whereas Jim Trout served the California State Lands Commission with distinction for over 28 years as a full-time employee and has served the state for a total of 57 years, and whereas Jim has served the California State Lands Commission as a retired annuitant since November 6, 1995, most of that time in the capacity of project coordinator for the Bolsa Chica Lowlands Restoration Project in Orange County, and whereas the restoration of Bolsa Chica is one of the largest wetlands projects ever undertaken in the United States of America, and whereas Jim has long had a vision and a passion for preserving and restoring the Bolsa Chica as habitat for the benefit of fish and wildlife and for the enjoyment of citizens of California and elsewhere, and whereas Jim worked tirelessly in many capacities to ensure that the Bolsa Chica lowlands would be available for restoration, including traveling to Washington, D.C. to meet with members of Congress and the federal administration. And whereas Jim has been a friend, advisor, supporter, cheerleader, and chair of the Bolsa Chica Wetlands Steering Committee of representatives from 8 agencies, both state and federal, providing insightful direction, crucial analysis, and meaningful comment regarding its actions. And whereas Jim's leadership, good judgment, and calm and pleasant demeanor have been instrumental in the steering committee's ability to achieve consensus on all major decisions, a feat rarely achieved in government or the private sector. And whereas Jim's unique combination of insight, intelligence, and persuasive ability have provided a steady direction to the restoration project when lesser individuals would have been abdicated the responsibility. And whereas future generations of western snowy plover, Belding Savannah Sparrow, California Lease Tern, and over 40 species of fish and other assorted rare plants and wildlife will owe their very being to Jim's unstinting dedication to their cause. And whereas the Commission and the people of California have truly benefited from Jim's wise counsel and guidance, leading to the adoption of a final design for the restoration project through the opening of the Ocean Inlet on August 24, 2006, and the critical first years of the project's operation. Therefore, be it resolved that the California State Lands Commission expresses its admiration and appreciation to Jim for these significant accomplishments and wishes him the very best as he winds down, or doesn't, his exceptionally productive and long extended career as a retired annuitant.
Thank you.
The next item is item 51. And this is starting the regular agenda. Is that right, Mr. Thayer?
50, I think, is next.
Oh, whoops. Okay.
And that is...
Is this the oil spill report?
This is the oil spill report.
Great. Okay.
And presentations will occur by several different staff members. Greg, are you first? Greg Scott?
Marina.
Marina
yes.
Is.
Yes.
Never mind.
Great.
Marina Voskanian, who's our assistant division chief with the Mineral Resources Management Division.
Thank you, Paul. And good morning, commissioners. As Paul mentioned, my name is Marina Voskanian, and I am the commission's Mineral Resources Management Assistant Division Chief. At its June commission meeting, the chair requested the commission staff to review oil production and marine terminal operations in state waters, and in light of the British Petroleum incident in Gulf of Mexico, report on the Commission's oil spill prevention activities, the effectiveness of these programs, and evaluate opportunities for improvement in the oil spill prevention programs. Commission staff has prepared a report addressing this subject that is included as Exhibit A in the calendar item, and we will now be presenting a brief overview of the report content. This report was prepared by four divisions of State Lands Commission, each addressing their specific functions and responsibilities with regard to oil and gas operations in state waters. I represent the Mineral Resources Management Division that is responsible for all oil, mineral, leasing, drilling, and production activities on state lands. I and one other staff member from our division will discuss those responsibilities. Following that, brief discussions of marine terminal operations, surface leasing, and environmental planning and management will be discussed by staff representing the other divisions. The MRMD divisions, as I said, Mineral Resources Management Division, oversees all offshore state oil and gas leases. We carry out those responsibilities through broad regulatory structures developed by this division, and also through comprehensive safety and spill prevention programs. The ability to operate these leases in the safest and most environmentally responsible manner allows for the most efficient development of the state's natural resources and resulting in significant revenues to the state. Our staff are highly trained engineers and technicians with considerable experience and backgrounds in the oil industry. All offshore state oil and gas activities are closely reviewed and analyzed by engineers, and if approved, they are carefully observed and monitored by state engineers, inspectors, and audited for safety and technical compliance by state facility auditors. There are generally 18 active leases in state waters that produce oil and gas from 4 offshore platforms and 2 man-made islands. As shown in this slide, Platform Holly is located in Santa Barbara County, Rincon Island in Ventura County, and in Orange County, we have Platform Esters, Eva, and Emmy. Although it's not a state lease, the Long Beach unit operates from 4 man-made islands and contributes a significant amount of revenue to the state. Sorry. 168 million barrels of oil have been produced from those operations over the past 10 years and have generated revenues of over $2.5 billion to the state general fund during that time. Spills are extremely infrequent and of very small size. From the oil production in the last 10 years that I just mentioned, spills totaling less than half a barrel occurred on the average each year, even though most of these spills are recorded in ounces and even drops, we strive to achieve a zero spill record. To maintain safety of these operations, it's important to have comprehensive regulations, strong spill prevention and safety programs. I would like to now introduce Mr. Jeff Plank, our division's planning and development manager. He will review our division's regulations and safety programs that will include specific recommendations to further improve the division's safety and spill prevention programs. Jeff will also discuss the BP oil spill that occurred in the Gulf of Mexico. Jeff?
Thank you, Marina. Good morning, commissioners. Commissioner Maldonado actually gave most of my presentation already. All oil and gas projects submitted to the state are processed through the Commission's Mineral Resources Management Division, which coordinates the review with engineering, operations, and the Commission's Environmental Division, and other sections and divisions as needed, depending on the scope of the project. The review is rigorous and comprehensive, ensures conformance with all state regulations, commission policies, and current industry practices, as well as a thorough California Environmental CEQA Act review, which will be discussed by our Environmental Division. If the project is to be done from an existing platform, an assessment of the structural integrity of the platform to perform the project may be required as well. A current oil spill contingency plan is also submitted by the applicant and reviewed by our operations section. If the project is approved, each and every well plan is reviewed again in specific areas to ensure adherence to the same factors I just described. Our regulations cover every aspect of the well from the initial site inspection to well completion and production. Each well plan must be submitted along with and approval from the state's Division of Oil and Gas for review by our staff, drilling and production engineers, and structural or civil engineers if warranted. At the end of the drilling phase, the production plan is reviewed by our production engineers and reservoir engineers. MRMD inspectors make daily visits to each facility and observe the pipeline routes offshore and facility for any signs of pollution and to verify general operations and royalty production. The detailed monthly platform inspections have been a central part of MRMD duties for more than 40 years. The heart of the inspections is function testing of the platform system safety, alarm, and control devices to ensure that they are working properly. The monthly inspection program is vital to ensuring that the platform pollution prevention systems and equipment operate reliably. In 2009, less than one deficiency per platform was found during the monthly inspections. We believe the low number of deficiencies found during the inspections confirms our programs and our lease operators' strong commitment to pollution prevention. Full safety audits are done on every state oil and gas facility every 5 years to ensure that oil platforms and the associated facilities continue to meet regulations and industry standards. The key step is to verify that the system safety alarm and control system designs will protect platform personnel and prevent pollution. The review requires our audit inspectors and engineers to do an on-site review of all the facilities' piping and instrumentation drawings and the inspection and maintenance records of all tanks, piping, and pressure vessels, the operator's training and qualification records, the platform operating manual procedures for normal upset and emergency shutdown conditions, and the spill prevention and response procedures. Finally, we do an in-depth evaluation of the company's safe management practices, also known as SAMs, to gain valuable insight into the safety culture that the operators' workers exhibit and the effectiveness of the company's safety practices. This is an effort to reduce the human error factors, which are usually found at the base cause of the types of disasters we've saw in the Gulf. We've come to understand the contributing factors and weaknesses that led to the failure to control the British Petroleum Macondo well. However, more information will be forthcoming once the well is permanently capped to determine the exact sequence of events that led to the well's blowout. Information gathered at government inquiries and industry reports have pointed to certain events and decisions that played a critical role, and a preliminary assessment of our regulations and policies can be made in light of those disclosures. Even though offshore drilling occurs in both the Gulf of Mexico and California, as Commissioner Maldonado pointed out, the differences between drilling environments are considerable, especially when discussing this Macondo well. The extreme depth of the water in the Macondo well's case, 5,000 feet, presents a unique set of engineering problems unseen in California state waters. The depth affects almost every aspect of the well, including the blowout prevention equipment, the rig type, the mud properties, the casing design, and the surveillance of the well in general. Wells in California state waters are rarely drilled in water depths over 200 feet. The production formation or oil reservoir in the Macondo well was 13,000 feet below the sea level or 18,000 feet below the drill floor, with an estimated formation pressure in excess of 10,000 pounds per square inch. Most oil reservoirs in the state waters produce from formations between 4 or 5,000 feet, with formation pressures at or near normal hydrostatic pressure, that is, under about 3,000 psi. Most wells are not exploratory, but are rather drilled in known mature fields where oil cannot naturally flow to the surface on its own, but needs to be pumped to the surface by artificial means, either by surface or subsurface pumps. While this does not mean that a blowout cannot occur, the risk is greatly reduced. Unfortunately, our wells are drilled within 3 miles from shore, and any large spill will almost immediately hit the shoreline, as opposed to the 50-mile buffer the Macondo well had. The blowout prevention equipment on the Macondo well did not close off the well bore and shut in the well as it was designed to do, although the cause of the failure is still unknown. The equipment appeared to be configured with the necessary redundancies to conform to industry and regulatory standards, as shown in this diagram. There were two of each type of preventer present in the stack and two control pods, which initiate the opening and closing of the equipment. It's known that the drilling crew was trying to close the preventers and knew there was a problem prior to the blowout. However, none of those men survived the explosion to document their actions. There were also reports that at least one of the rams was not hooked up right and that there were leaks in the hydraulic lines to the blowout preventer stack, the latter of which conceivably may have been one of the factors leading to the failure of the equipment. The exact cause of the failure will only be known once the well is completely capped and the blowout preventer stack can be brought back up to the surface. The state blowout prevention equipment requirements also provide for redundancies in design on both surface and subsea applications. The equipment is required to be fully tested at regular intervals, and the initial installation pressure tests are to be witnessed and approved by the Division of Oil and Gas personnel. The commission requires the function test, in other words, making sure that they actually operate, on the preventers on a daily basis, and they have to be fully tested at least once a week while drilling. The test must be reported on the drilling record sheet on the daily well report sent to the commission staff. Since all state wells are currently drilled from fixed platforms or onshore sites, the blowout prevention equipment is located on the surface, which makes testing, maintenance, and witnessing easier and safer. The details of the Macondo well and the decisions made by the BP personnel for the casing design are still under investigation. It's also not known what level of technical review was made by the regulatory agency. However, the record shows that the decision to run the final casing string to surface may not have been based on the best engineering principles, and as such lacked another mechanical seal that most other deep water and deep wells in general possess. The casing program on each individual state well is reviewed by qualified engineers and MRMD, and the type of casing and proposed setting depths are based on all relevant geologic and engineering factors and must be justified by calculations of competency of the preceding casing shoe, estimated reservoir pressure, and the estimated fracture gradient, that is, the point at which the formation would fail at the previous casing shoe. Staff reviews the cementing procedure for each casing string included in the drilling program. That is, after steel, the steel casing is lowered into the well after it's been drilled. After the casing is lowered into the hole, liquid cements pump down the well in such a manner that it fills the space between the drilled hole and the outside of the casing. It's critical to give the cement enough time to go through this semi-solid stage so that when it hardens or sets, it creates an impermeable seal between the casing and the drilled hole. Commission regulations require production casing cement coverage to a minimum of 500 feet above the highest oil and gas zones, which I believe is also the federal requirement. Indications are that there may not have been enough cement pumped in to obtain this on the Macondo well. Our regulations also require a minimum of 24 hours waiting on the cement to cure or the time indicated by pre-testing of the actual cement used at the temperature and pressure of the setting depth to determine the proper setting time to achieve the required strength. It's believed that the Macondo well failed to do either. And finally, a cement bond log or equivalent survey is required on intermediate production casing in the state to ensure adequate cement fill and cement bonding has been achieved. The log is submitted to staff for review. No such log was run on the Macondo well. Finally, the commission requires daily drilling reports to be called in or faxed to MRMD for review by one of our engineers on a daily basis during all drilling activity. We understand, and as Commissioner Maldonado pointed out, that because of the limited staff and the extensive number of drilling operations in the Gulf of Mexico, that the MMS received these reports only on a weekly basis, and we do not know what level of review they were subjected. We can assure the commission staff that staff constantly reviews industry and academic articles and reports and final reports from inquiries as to the cause of every major worldwide problem and reviews the finding against our current regulation, lease terms, and commission policies in order to maintain and improve our safety and prevention programs. Our recommendations are to direct staff to move forward with updating the Commission's offshore drilling and production regulations. We have been doing this on an informal basis for quite a while, and we're prepared to take them through the OAL process here shortly, probably waiting until we find out what the exact causes of the Macondo problem were. We would like for the Commission to recommend to renew our effort from 2000 for legislation to give the Commission cease and desist authority over operations in state waters. We don't have the authority right now to shut down an operation. We would like to see we've been hit with a rash of retirements over the last year or so, and we'd like to see the MRMD staff vacancies filled And finally, we'd like to reclassify the Mineral Resources Inspector Series to include the Inspector Specialist position and adjust the pay scales to provide a modern, fully functional inspection program. I'd like to introduce now Kevin Mercer with our Marine Facility Division to discuss the operations on marine terminals.
Good morning, Commissioners. I am Kevin Mercer. I'm the Assistant Division Chief of the State Lands Commission Marine Facilities Division. The Marine Facilities Division was established in 1990, subsequent to the Lempert-Keene Sea Strand Oil Spill Prevention and Response Act. We regulate and oversee operations at marine oil terminals where tank ships load and unload. MFD has field offices in Long Beach and Hercules in the Bay Area. We monitor the operations of terminals from Eureka all the way down to San Diego. The act was actually a reaction to an oil spill in 1990 off of Huntington Beach at a state lands leased offshore terminal. MFD is a fourth generation quality management organization with an experienced marine safety and engineering staff. Our mandates and style, I guess I should get there. That was an F. F?
This one.
Oh, geez. There you go. Okay. There we go. Our mandates and style are depicted in this slide. We use a plan, do, check, act process. At the top, we develop regulations and standards. We review and approve operations manuals. We monitor oil transfers and inspect facilities. Terminals are onshore, offshore, and mobile transfer units. Our inspectors are in the field 7 days a week. We take the information that we gather from the field operations and continuously feed it back into our operations, new regulations, new procedures. We routinely form technical advisory groups to consult with us on our proposed regulations. Starting in 1991, our inspectors were in the field immediately upon hiring, and we were out there ensuring that the marine terminals were conforming with the Coast Guard regulations. Realizing that we could do more, in late 91 and 92, we accepted most of and improved upon the Coast Guard regulations by stewarding through California rules through the regulatory process. In 1994, we added regulations to increase the training standards for personnel at terminals, including the transfer workers, management, and even the outside contractors that work at terminals. Terminal pipeline regulations were added in 1998, requiring more stringent and effective testing and maintenance requirements than the federal rules required. After 9/11, 2001, marine terminal safety regulations were adopted to ensure that terminals performed security risk assessments and had security plans in place. These were the first regulations at oil terminals in the country after 9/11. In 2006, the Building Standards Commission adopted MFD-crafted regulations for marine oil terminal engineering and maintenance standards, MOTEMs. The average age of the 30 California onshore terminals is 50 years. MOTEMs is the first in the world comprehensive set of policies and procedures to evaluate the fitness for purpose of onshore marine terminals. Every day, more than 91 million gallons are transferred across California docks. Spills at the terminals are few and far between, and they're very small. They are often measured in just drops or sheens. In 2009, there were 9 oil spills that totaled only 124 gallons. That's roughly 3 barrels. The numbers are even smaller when you only count the terminal spills and not the vessel spills at the docks. Contrast that with more than 33 billion gallons transferred at the docks every year. While the amount transferred has been fairly flat over the last few years, the actual number of spills are going down. Annually, the total number of transfers at California terminals is between 6,000 and over 7,000. The MFD Marine Safety Staff has a presence at 45% of these transfers. They are actually the cops on the beat. Our Marine Safety Staff averages more than 31 years of maritime experience. Transfers are prioritized using an algorithm relating to the degree of risk assigned to the vessels and the terminal's history. All vessels calling California for the first time are met by our staff. MOTAM's audits reveal existing conditions of the terminals, determine their actual safe working parameters, and identify remedial action priorities. Audits include above and below water inspections, seismic analysis, and mooring and berthing analysis, fire detection and suppression systems, pipelines, and mechanical and electrical systems are evaluated. Completed audits are required to provide timetables for any rehabilitation necessary from the findings. 27 high and medium risk terminals have submitted their audits, and the audits are being reviewed by our staff. MOTEM's compliance is expected in 2015. We have a couple of recommendations, actually three. Our division needs two more engineering inspectors to oversee the actual implementation of the MOTEM's rehabilitations at the docks. There's going to be a tremendous amount of construction at the California oil terminals. We need three specialists to establish and carry out a safety systems audit program to closely review whether or not the terminals themselves are managing their changes and the interaction of these new changes on the dock with the operations personnel. The Oil Spill Prevention Administration Fund provides 39% of the State Lands Commission budget. The OSPF is projected to show a serious deficit of over $3 million by the end of fiscal year 2011 and 2012. And Lieutenant Governor Maldonado, you mentioned those great California people down in the Gulf that were helping them down there. I'm sure that most of those people, if not all, are paid for out of this fund. And the fund's going to go negative in a couple of years. And California has been very fortunate to have the spill prevention programs that we have and the contingency plan programs that we have. And I can assure you there's no other state that has anything like that. Thank you. Are there any questions? Well, I'd like to introduce Brian Bush of our Land Management Division.
Good morning, Commissioners. Only two more of us to go, so hang in there. We'll try and keep it quick, and I guarantee we'll get it done quicker than the BP plugged that well out there. The Land Management Division has primary responsibility for the surface leasing and for the surface management of all sovereign and school lands in California. With respect to the oil-related activities, LMD is responsible for leasing of marine oil terminals and many of the rights of way accommodating oil pipelines and other conduits linking offshore oil facilities with the offshore oil platforms with the onshore facilities. We work cooperatively with our other divisions that you're hearing from here today, MRMD, MFD, and DEPM staff, to put provisions in the leases that are applicable to these types of leases. Some of the key provisions that we cover that are pertinent to our discussion today here are those dealing with the use and maintenance of the lease premises and the steps to be taken in the event of an oil spill or other discharge. So I'll go through those very quickly. For new construction, lessees must provide construction plans, construction monitoring reports, and as-builts once the construction is complete. Lessees maintain their records of all inspections, repair, testing, and maintenance activities and provide copies of those to SLC staff. Lessees provide copies of all pipeline test procedures prior to testing for state land staff's review and approval. The lessees need prior approval from staff for any repairs, modifications, or improvements to the pipeline. And from the safety perspective, the lessee's operators must conduct training classes and periodic drills simulating a pipeline leak and the procedures they would follow in the event of a leak. They must provide copies of the hazardous spill contingency plans. And every lessee also has specific notification requirements in the event of a spill. They have to provide a 24-hour emergency contact phone number, and then other information they need to provide are the date and the time of the spill, source of the spill, the responsible parties, the substance spilled, the quantity spilled, the cause of the spill if known, and the action taken. So all of this is part and parcel with their responsibilities under different regulations, and we put those into the lease conditions to make them a little more prominent. On a secondary level, we also do leases for commercial marinas that have fuel docks. And for these, we incorporate many of the same provisions we require in the leases for those involving oil. There's a best management practices for marina operators and owners. They cover a range of different ones, but the ones applicable for oil and fuel spills are those dealing with petroleum management, hazardous waste, and liquid waste. And those are detailed in the report. In terms of recommendations, we're like all the other divisions in the, because of the Gulf oil spill, we've initiated a review of our leasing practices and provisions. And a few of the things that we're are looking into also including are, whenever possible, we've been reviewing leases for the adequacy of bond and insurance amounts in the attempt to bring the older leases up to date to make the levels of coverage commensurate with the level of risk involved. Consent item number 42 today is an example of that. There was a transfer in ownership for the San Pedro Bay pipeline as a result of the of a bankruptcy, and we worked with the new owners who are here today, I think back there, to increase the insurance levels on the lease from $10 million to $50 million. We're also looking to add provisions to new leases allowing state land staff to review and adjust insurance bond amounts at the five-year anniversary rates, as much as we do the rent reviews. And then we're also looking at requirements to retrofit or modify old pipelines to allow for smart pigging so we can keep those clean. And then allowing state land staff to review oil contingency plans. That's it from ours. I'd like to introduce Cy Oggins, who's the chief of our Environmental Planning and Management Division.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. Again, my name is Cy Oggins, and I'm Chief of the Division of Environmental Planning and Management. We are the smallest of the four line divisions of the Commission, with 11 staff, including 9 environmental scientist professionals. Our primary role is to ensure compliance with the California Environmental Quality Act. Our primary objective is to provide, to ensure that the Commission has, that is, you have, sufficient information to approve with conditions, or to deny proposed projects that have the potential to result in an oil spill. As you know, the Commission receives numerous applications for projects that have the potential to cause an oil spill. Proposed oil development projects have included Trankian Ridge, offshore Santa Barbara County, which the Commission denied in 2009. Other applications relate to marine oil terminals. They include lease renewals for the Chevron Long Wharf Marine Terminal in San Francisco Bay, and the Elwood Marine Terminal offshore Goleta that the Commission approved in 2007 and 2009. Planning staff analyzed potential impacts associated with oil spills in environmental impact reports, or EIRs, prepared by staff assisted by environmental consulting firms that are working for the Commission. Our CEQA process is designed to ensure that other agencies and the public are provided with multiple opportunities to participate in the environmental review process, to ensure that potential significant impacts such as oil spills are identified, to ensure that feasible project alternatives are evaluated, to ensure that mitigation measures to reduce oil spill risks to the maximum extent feasible are formulated, and to ensure that projects that are approved by the Commission are monitored so that Commission-adopted measures and applicant-proposed measures to mitigate oil spill impacts are in fact implemented. The Commission's Environmental Program Planning and Management staff is committed to providing superior environmental review to the Commission and the public, and we will continue to communicate and coordinate with our agency partners, the public, and applicants at all steps of the process. We'll endeavor to monitor and assess the effectiveness of oil spill mitigation measures and to incorporate lessons learned into future EIRs that we bring to the Commission. And we'll seek to enhance staff's data and information gathering processes, including the use of geographic information systems, if feasible, to make sure that our data is more readily available to the public and the agencies. Now Paul Thayer will conclude the staff's presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Batting cleanup here. Again, a long presentation and a lot to get through here, but we felt in light of what happened in the Gulf and the media attention to the potential for oil spills, it was important for the commissioners to know of the detail and the particularities of our oil spill programs. And there are many, and as you heard today, we have a lot of dedicated staff who are highly trained and whose purpose is to prevent oil spills in California. We have a variety of recommendations. And to summarize those just quickly, we believe the current regulations need to be updated, particularly with respect to bonding requirements, training requirements, and equipment requirements. We think new legislation is appropriate to give a cease and desist authority. Right now, we cannot on our own go out either in any of our programs and say this practice is unsafe, you should stop operating. For marine oil terminals, the only way we have to do this is to go to the Coast Guard and get them to stop it. The operation, or to go to the oil spill administrator in Fish and Game. So we'd like to have our own authority to do that.
How many times have you done that, Paul?
How many times have you gone to the Coast Guard and said you need to stop?
Probably.
What use the microphone?
Yes.
I don't really have it handy exactly, but it probably happens two or three times a year at least. Frankly, we've been training the Coast Guard personnel in current years or recent years, and so they really trust us. I mean, they know that we're out there, and when we ask for it, we typically get it. But it's kind of squeezy when we got to go ask them to come out and enforce something for us. Although we may never use it or we may not use it very often, it would be nice to kind of have that little hammer, you know, available to us when somebody, you know, decides that they don't want to stop doing what they're doing in the middle of the night.
And then the allied concern is that our regulations currently do not allow us to shut down a platform if we think there's an unsafe condition. Our regs only provide for us to be able to keep a platform closed if it's already been shut down because of an accident. And we think we need the authority to be able to say, no, you have to stop. Another one of the legislative recommendations was that the per barrel fee, which funds most of our oil spill programs as well as Fish and Game's oil spill response programs, should be raised. And in fact, there is legislation that's been introduced this year to raise that another penny and to put a CPI on that to keep it that fund healthy. As one of the other speakers mentioned, our programs are funded by that. There had been a surplus in that fund, but the operations of the state now cost more than what we're annually putting to that fund, so that surplus is soon to disappear. On the next one, we're talking about filling vacancies which recently have occurred, and I want to apologize. Earlier on, when we were discussing the audit, I mentioned that we'd like to see if we can get some more appraisers. We understand fully that the state is in, you know, almost an unprecedented economic situation, and that a variety of agencies have vital functions that are not being funded. And in some respects, this is exactly the same sort of thing. We understand that we may need to use our existing resources until we get past this situation. Nonetheless, we felt it was important to identify these needs and establish the basis so that in the future, when more resources are available, we'll go after them. The MRMD vacancies as well as the MFD vacancies are often funded by this OSPAF fund, so that we may be able to obtain some relief on that because they're not reliant on the general fund. We're looking to reclassify the inspector series so that we're able to compete more successfully for skilled new staff. And as Cy mentioned, we'd like to do more to enhance and organize the EIR data that we accumulate so that we can use them in a general sense to deal with these issues. So that concludes staff recommendation or the staff report. I should mention a couple of things. First, as we've continuously alluded to, the final investigations on the Deepwater Horizon spill aren't done yet. And we are likely to come back with more recommendations depending upon what's found there. That, you know, we want to be educated by that. The other thing I wanted to note before closing is that we've had two staff that have been down there. We had one staff that was called up active duty Coast Guard. He's in the reserves to go down there and assist in the spill cleanup. And Gary Gregory, who's Kevin's boss, chief of our Marine Facilities Division, was offered a job down there for a month doing management, high-level management, and took a month vacation to go down there. We think the net result for us is going to be great because he's had all this training down there and experience, and he'll be able to benefit California's program as well. He just got back this week. So that concludes our presentations, if there are any questions from the commissioners. Otherwise, we would ask, the calendar item indicated this was for information purposes, but we'd like the commission stamp of approval on those so that, you know, that we'd be able to go out and seek the legislation and understand that we're satisfying the commission with our other recommended actions.
Thank you, Paul, very much, and thank you, staff, for the comprehensive and important report. Are there any comments from commissioners? Ms. Bryan.
I find myself in a quandary here, because I think when I read the staff report, I was really impressed with it and thought, you know, we're doing a lot of things to within our lands to prevent oil spills. And you know, I remember 69, I was actually alive and remember tar on my foot. And, you know, so I'm really always concerned about it. But I think something happened to me here today, and it started, I think, with the Lieutenant Governor's presentation and his photographs from the Gulf, and it got me thinking that maybe what we didn't really do in this report is challenge ourselves to really ask the hard questions, because in some ways I think we don't have all the information in terms of what happened in the Gulf, but I don't think we ask ourselves, are we doing everything that we can possibly do to prevent oil spills? I think I think that the report reflects an acceptance by the staff and by the commission that we are doing what we need to do, but I don't think it answers that really hard question of, is there more that we should be doing? I think I'm explaining this too well, because I was thinking of it as I was going through, but it's like, it articulates, this is what we're doing, and we're doing a lot, and we have really competent, able staff that's doing a good job, and maybe we need a few more, but to me, it's like we're kind of tiptoeing around the edges. It's like, we didn't start with a blank piece of paper and really challenge ourselves. Is there something that we should be doing differently? And maybe that's a conversation that needs to take place across the entire state, because I know we have a lot of agencies that are doing, that do oil spill prevention work and look at this. But I got to tell you, if the lieutenant governor from the state of Louisiana has to fly out here and look at something that happens off our coast, and we are saying, well, we just couldn't hire enough inspectors or we didn't have enough money, it's just not going to be a satisfactory answer. So I think, I don't know how to move forward on this, but I think that we owe it to ourselves to make sure that in our lands that we are doing everything humanly possible. And maybe just, you know, maybe it's a question of each division looking at the other division's work and really, rather than starting with here's what we do now and we think it's working, if we had a little bit more around the edges, it'd be great. It's asking the harder question. Are we doing everything we absolutely can to protect the coast of California from a catastrophic spill? And I get the fact that all the conditions in the Gulf are dramatically different than ours, but it's like, it would be like we just had an earthquake and we didn't go back in and ask those hard questions. And I don't know exactly how to move that forward, but I think that's kind of the heart of what the controller's original question was, and I think it's the heart of what the lieutenant governor brought to the table today, and I think that we should take a page out of both of those playbooks and ask the question a different way.
That makes sense. I guess in response I'd say that it is true that a large part of this presentation focuses on what we're doing already, but I think that after something like the Louisiana spill occurs, there's this presumption that the existing programs there didn't work, and therefore you know, California must be unprepared itself. There's kind of an immediate jump to that. We felt it was important to present what we were doing as kind of the base from which we would then make further advances. There may be fundamentally different ways that we can approach things, but in all likelihood, we're going to build off of the successes we've had already, the kinds of processes that we've learned through a lot of experience that makes sense. I agree with the commissioner entirely, though, that we cannot be complacent. And, I mean, I think the stats show that we have caused the oil spills to decline. There has been some success, but we're still not down to zero. And as long as we can keep coming up with more ways to be a more effective program, that's what we should be doing. I'm not quite sure what you would like, what your comments imply in terms of next steps, where what you would like us to do differently.
I think maybe I can take it. We can think about it a little bit. It might be a statewide response, looking really, you know, a tabletop exercise, or really challenging ourselves to think this through. And part of it is all of resources in state government are dwindling, and it is, you know, you see it. Headline in the LA Times, and you want to immediately go out and draft legislation, you want to immediately go out and fix this problem. I see it every day in my day-to-day life. You know, something is mentioned. In some ways, the audit has a little bit of that flavor to it, too. But I think on the question of oil spill, it's just so fundamental to California. It's having our coastline destroyed would be similar to having the Golden Gate Bridge collapse, or having having Yosemite cave in on itself because of some man-made disaster. It's something that I think that it's just at the very highest level we need to think about. So we can talk about it some more. I don't know if my fellow commissioners have any thoughts. I think we have, you know, we're doing little things here, like we have our resolution in a later agenda item. I think it's really worth taking the recommendations the Lieutenant Governor made and very seriously thinking about maybe a third-party inspection on top of the stuff we're already doing might be something we should think about, or do we need to change our worst-case scenarios from 7 days to 30 days? And it probably is a statewide effort, but I think as the State Lands Commission, we should think about leading on this issue.
I understand. Curtis passed me a copy of the flyer, the announcement. You know, the commission does sponsor the Prevention First Conference, which occurs every other year, and the next version of that's going to be October 19th and 20th. And, of course, the commissioners have a standing invitation not only to attend, but if we always make space available if they would like to make presentations. But this is one of a whole variety of efforts. Spills are caused by so many different things. It's not just Deepwater Horizon. It can be because some guy wasn't trained properly, or the corporate culture is not safety conscious. And when you look at the breadth of our programs, we're trying to, each year it seems like we're looking for some other thing that can be done that will help cut off the next spill. You look at two of the significant spills that have occurred over the last 10 or 15 years, they were both caused not because there was a lack of equipment or even warning that the spill was occurring. The operator turned off the safety device. I mean, these were the ones where we had the pipeline break that affected Platform Irene oil coming ashore. And the same thing happened in Sassoon, where pipelines, the systems detected that there was a drop in pressure and therefore likely to be a spill. And the operator said, oh, well, we don't see any spill. Let's turn it on again, and then we'll see the spill when it comes out and that kind of thing. So you look at that and you go, God, you know, what do you do? And you think, well, that's not an equipment problem. That's a person problem. We need to do the training. So it's, you know, I hate to use this analogy, but it's a little bit like nailing jelly to a wall, that you cannot have one approach to it. You have to come up with a whole lot of different methods of dealing with this. There's just so many ways an accident can happen. And this, having been to a bunch of these Prevention First conferences through the years, the commissioners might be very interested in this, because you look at the detail and the science involved and what's being looked at. I remember one of them in particular that unfortunately is not here, Martin Eskegian was running, but they were modeling the effect of passing ships on tankers that were tied up. So what's the effect? How much does the ship that's tied up move? How do you engineer so that the arm that's coming over and taking the oil off that tanker isn't going to break? Or what speed should the passing tanker be kept to prevent that from happening? It's just one example of a gazillion different ways. But you're right. We can get down in the bushes sometimes and maybe miss the forest for the trees, and any assistance the commission can give us in terms of making sure we don't do that would be great. Frankly, although we, you know, as a staff, we understood we needed to look at the spill for how it would inform our process, the commissioner's interest and, you know, their actions at the last meeting telling us they'd like to see a comprehensive review and the preparation of this report helps staff in terms of make sure that it lets us know that the commissioners are interested and that there's a mission here that we need to focus on. But any other direction from the commission is appreciated.
Okay. Well, I know, as Cynthia said, a spill would be extraordinarily devastating, especially a big spill. And so it's a great idea to pursue additional self-examination. But I think that the self-examination that occurred in this report is worthwhile. And so I'll move to adopt these recommendations. And also, if Cynthia likes to give direction to pursue something in addition.
Is this an action item?
It was noted as an informational item. However, we want to make sure that, for example, in the legislation, is that something the commission wants us to pursue? As I indicated, there are only two recommendations. One of them is already being carried out, and we could support that bill that would raise that the fee per barrel fee by one penny. The other one was to pursue the cease and desist authority. Yeah. And then the other portions are staff-generated concepts, so if the commission would rather wait until we bring that back and doesn't have any problem with what we're doing and could somehow indicate that to us, that'd be great.
But just, Madam Chair, since it wasn't an action item, I didn't make the calls that I like to make to people who are in industry, people that will be affected, to see what their opinions are.
Sure.
You know, and it's difficult for me to say yes on something that I wasn't prepared to just vote for today. I'd love to bring it back if we may, and then I can be prepared, fully prepared, on step by step what I'm voting on, or maybe we separate them. But I think this is very, very important. But like I said, I wasn't prepared today to cast a vote on something that was not an action item. I thought it was just a presentation. We were going to have comments from commissioners and public comments, if any, and then we would go from there.
We'd be glad to bring it back in that circumstance. Then.
Is there any public comment? Okay. And so there is a motion on the table. Is it... die for lack of a second? Okay. So the motion has died for lack of a second. And we'll look at this next time and hopefully get these recommendations moving then.
Certainly.
Okay. So item 51 is next. It's to consider approval of the report to the legislature involving ballast water treatment systems for use in California waters. Can we have the staff presentation? Hi, Nicole.
Sorry.
There are two speaker slips for this item, so if there's anyone else who wants to speak, please fill out a speaker slip and turn it in. Thank you.
The commission will recall that this was brought to the commission at the last meeting, and at the direction of the commission, we've gone back and reviewed the report and tried to make it more consistent in tone, both at the beginning and the end, to match up with the facts that are in it. And Nicole will discuss this.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Commissioners. My name is Nicole Dabrowski. I am a staff environmental scientist with the Commission's Marine Facilities Division. I'm here today to present to you the revised report, 2010 Assessment of the Efficacy, Availability, and Environmental Impacts of Ballast Water Treatment Technologies for Use in California Waters. The report, which is mandated by statute, examines the availability of ballast water treatment systems to meet California's performance standards for the discharge of ballast water. Specifically, this report assesses the availability of treatment systems for newly built vessels with a ballast water capacity greater than 5,000 metric tons. These vessels must comply with California performance standards beginning January 1 of 2012. The first draft of the report was brought before the Commission on June 28th of this year. The Commissioners requested that staff revise the report to ensure that its conclusions more thoroughly reflected the variability and uncertainty regarding the assessment of available ballast water treatment technologies to meet California's performance standards. Staff has made the requested revisions. The executive summary and the conclusions have been amended to reflect the fact that while multiple treatment technologies have demonstrated the potential to meet California's performance standards, further development will be necessary in order to deem them ready for use in California waters. Additionally, as requested by the Commission, staff has indicated in the report that they will prepare an updated report by September 1st of 2011. This update will allow the Commission to closely track the progress of technology development to ensure that systems will be available prior to the implementation of the standards on January 1st of 2012. Staff continues to believe that based on the available data and the lead time available for further technology development and refinement, that technologies will be available by the time these vessels are operational in California waters, which will likely be in 2014 or later. The recommendations to the legislature from the first report have not been changed. Staff recommends that the Commission proceed with implementation of the standards as planned for vessels with construction initiated on or after January 1 of 2012. And then with approval of this report, staff will submit it to the legislature for their information and review. And I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Comments from commissioners? Questions?
Thank you. It's so much better, and I really, really appreciate. I know it's a pain to have to redo it, but it reads a lot better. Thank you.
I agree.
Okay, great. We've got two public commenters. First is John Berg, followed by Victoria Rome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioners. My name is John Berg. I'm Vice President with Pacific Merchant Shipping Association. We represent shipping lines that serve California's ports. I'd like to begin by thanking the Commission for their action at the June meeting to remand the report back to staff for these additional edits. And those edits did, we believe, correct misleading statements regarding the current state of treatment technology, which suggested the technology could perform acceptably in meeting the state standard. While we greatly appreciate those efforts, we must still respectfully disagree with the report's predictions that existing technology will be able to meet the standard in 2012 or shortly thereafter. As documented in the evidence presented in our earlier comments, academics, researchers, regulatory agencies, and treatment technology vendors are on record as agreeing with our conclusion. And this is partly, I think, due to or a function of the current lack of testing and verification protocols designed around this more stringent state standard than the protocols that they're using right now for testing, and also partly a function of the capabilities of these technologies. Now, there are several studies underway at the federal level to address the same issues we're dealing with and some of the questions we're asking here in California. The results of those studies should be available in 2011, and we believe they will further support our conclusions. Therefore, the Commission showed good foresight in requesting an interim report in 2011, and we hope that that report will incorporate the findings of these other studies. But unfortunately, 2012 is approaching rapidly, and ship owners are needing to plan on design and system utilization soon. So we therefore must again urge the Commission to more clearly recognize the limitations of technology in meeting the California standard, and would recommend that either the standard be modified, the implementation schedule be delayed, or a combination of those two. And again, thank you very much for considering our comments.
Thank you. Ms. Rome?
Good morning. I'm Victoria Rome. I'm with the Natural Resources Defense Council. I'm here to urge you to approve the Commission staff's revised legislative report regarding ballast water treatment systems, and I have just a few brief points. California has been a national leader in developing long overdue regulations to address invasive species discharged in vessels' ballast water, and it is critically important that this effort continue on schedule. Thanks to the Commission's leadership, California was the first state to adopt strict standards to limit the amount of invasive species that vessels can dump along our coasts in their ballast water. Similar standards should have been required by US EPA and the Coast Guard under federal law, but is only because of the leadership of California and other states that any significant progress has been made at the federal level. The Commission staff's report accurately finds that technology is developing rapidly and that at least 8 treatment systems are commercially available that demonstrate the potential to meet California's standards. Again, we support approval of the staff report today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We have a motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
The report is approved. The next item, 52, is to consider termination of a recreational pier lease and to authorize ejectment proceedings. Can we have the staff presentation?
That presentation will be made by Vicki Caldwell, who is from our Land Management Division.
Good morning, Commissioner. My name is Vicki Caldwell. I'm a public land management specialist with the Commission's Land Management Division. I'm here to present information on calendar item 52. This item asks the Commission to confirm staff's finding
that Larry M. Hamilton and Laura B. Hamilton, trustees of the Larry and Laura Hamilton Trust, dated January 3, 2006, are in default of their lease for the reasons to be described in this presentation. As background, Commission staff received a lease application on June 4, 2007, from the Hamilton's consultant for the construction, use, and maintenance of an uncovered floating boat dock, pilings, and a gangway located on the Sacramento River adjacent to their upland home located at 14065 River Road in Walnut Grove. This exhibit is what the Commission approved in the lease. The lease application included information regarding permits that had been obtained from the Department of Fish and Game, the State Reclamation Board, and the Reclamation District number 554. In addition, the application reported that several other permits and consultations from the Central Valley Regional Water Quality Control Board, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers were under review but not yet completed. The application was deemed complete, and staff negotiated a lease that included construction-related lease provisions in Section 3, Paragraph 3 and 4, that required the Hamiltons to provide Commission 15 days' notice prior to the start of construction and within 60 days of completion of construction, confirm when construction was completed, and submit photographs and as-built drawings of the authorized improvements. And in Section D, Paragraph 8, that required the Hamiltons to obtain and maintain all federal, state, and local permits and entitlements for the term of the lease. The Hamiltons agreed to the terms of the lease, and at its October 30th, 2007 meeting, the Commission authorized a new 10-year recreational pier lease to the Hamiltons for their project. Between October 2008 and April 2009, staff sent several letters requesting that the Hamiltons respond to the construction provisions of the lease. The Hamiltons failed to respond to staff about the construction, and the dock was constructed sometime in 2008. On July 23, 2009, Commission staff was notified by the Army Corps of Engineers that the Hamiltons were in violation of Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act, because they constructed the dock without obtaining an Army Corps permit, and that the dock was constructed in an Army Corps Delta Smelt mitigation site. The Corps requested the docking facilities be removed. The next photo will show the constructed dock and the mitigation site. Between August and October 2009, staff sent letters to the Hamiltons and their consultant requesting status of their efforts to resolve this violation. Neither the Hamiltons nor their consultant responded. On June 7, 2010, staff received a second notice of violation from the Army Corps that the Hamiltons remained in violation, and staff learned that the Hamiltons had not responded to the first notice of violation in 2009. On July 14, 2010, Commission staff gave formal written notice to the Hamiltons that they were in default of their lease, and pursuant to the terms of their lease, they had 30 days to cure the default. Staff further notified them that if they did not comply within 30 days, staff would recommend termination of the lease for consideration by the Commission. On July 29, 2010, staff received a letter from the Hamiltons' consultant in which they advised that the Hamiltons would be pursuing this matter with the Army Corps of Engineers to rectify the situation regarding the Army Corps permit, and requested a postponement of this action before you while they are engaged with the Army Corps and compiling the photographs and as-built drawings. On August 9, 2010, staff responded to the Hamiltons and their consultant and that the item would remain on the agenda because the Hamiltons knowingly constructed the docking facility without obtaining the required permits and because of their failure to comply with the terms of their lease pertaining to the construction of the dock. The next photo will show, as you can see, how it is overgrown, the bank, the mitigation site. And the final will show the completed mitigation by the Army Corps. Staff is requesting that the Commission grant authorization to staff to issue a notice of termination and take the necessary legal action to eject the Hamiltons and remove the facilities if the Hamiltons fail to submit necessary documents required by the lease and take prompt action to remedy the permit issues with the Army Corps. In conclusion, staff is recommending that the Commission first find that the Hamiltons, as trustee of the Larry and Laura Hamilton Family Trust, dated January 3, 2006, are in default of their lease PRC 8765.9 because they have not complied with Section D, Paragraph 8 of the lease, where they agreed to obtain and maintain all permits relating to the construction of their dock, and Section E, Paragraph 3 and 4, where they agreed to provide 15 days notice prior to the start of construction and within 60 days of completion of construction, confirm when construction was completed, and submit photographs and as-built drawings. 2, authorize staff to issue a notice of termination of lease PRC 8765.9. And 3, authorize staff and the Office of the Attorney General to take all necessary steps, including litigation, to eject Larry M. Hamilton and Laura B. Hamilton, trustees of the Larry and Laura Hamilton Family Trust, dated January 3, 2006, from state sovereign land to seek removal of the docking facilities, to seek restoration of sovereign lands at this location to its natural condition prior to the placement of the improvements to the satisfaction of the Commission, to seek other such remedies available for the breach of the lease, and to recover the Commission's damages and costs. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you. Comments from commissioners? I have a question.
Why is this going this route? They can't afford to pay it, or they don't want to pay it, or
they haven't contacted the Army Corps to set up a meeting to resolve this issue.
Given their recent letter, they might finally be seeing the light of day that this is something that needs to be done. I mean, to their credit, they got the authorization from us and from several different agencies, but just neglected to do it from the other two and neglected to give us the as-built plans and all the other things that every other lessee needs. From my perspective, I'm hoping the fact that we've gotten this letter and if the Commission takes this action today, that they'll understand they could lose their dock and that they'll take the appropriate steps to fix the situation. And from our perspective, that would be a satisfactory result. The dock could stay if they would get the Corps permit, give us the as-builts and the pictures and everything else that needs to be done, and we'd be done with it. But we've reached the point as a staff where we need your help to bring that about.
Thank you. Do we have a motion?
One of the recommendation.
No second to staff recommendation.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Staff recommendation is approved. Item 53 is to consider termination of a holdover month-to-month occupation of state lands, denial of an application for a lease, and to authorize ejectment proceedings. May we have this staff presentation?
Thank you. Ms. Clark, from our land management division, one of the other land agents, will make this presentation.
Good morning, commissioners. My name is Michelle Clark. I am with the land management division. Oh, sure. Today I'll be presenting information on calendar item 53. The item before you involves an application for a commercial lease from Ron Sorensen, doing business as the Rio Ramaza Marina, for the continued use of a previously authorized commercial marina, now consisting of a boat launch, gangways, walkways, uncovered floating boat docks, and pilings on approximately 3.5 acres of sovereign land in the bed of the Sacramento River, adjacent to 10,000 Garden Highway in Sutter County. As background, on July 30, 1970, the Commission authorized a 25-year commercial lease to 4J Investments Incorporated, doing business as the Rio Ramaza Marina. That lease expired on July 31, 1999, and went into holdover status. A little over a month later, the upland property and the marina were sold to Ron Sorensen, and shortly thereafter, staff of the Commission became aware of the ownership transfer and began notifying Mr. Sorensen that a new lease was required for the marina facilities. Between 1999 and 2008, staff sent several letters, made phone calls, and performed several site visits in an attempt to bring Mr. Sorensen under lease. During that period, Mr. Sorensen made periodic rent payments, which staff accepted. Staff considers the lease to be in a month-to-month holdover tenancy. During the site visits, staff observed that the docks had fallen into disrepair and continued to deteriorate. In October 2008, Mr. Sorensen finally submitted a lease application along with a $6,000 minimum expense deposit to process the application. At that time, Mr. Sorensen owed outstanding rent, including penalty and interest, for the period of August 1, 2006 through July 31, 2009. Staff informed Mr. Sorensen that in order to process the application, the back rent must be paid, and he agreed to apply the $6,000 deposit toward the outstanding rent. Staff then requested an additional $3,000 to cover the minimum expense deposit to continue processing the application. At that time, the marina manager notified staff that the deteriorated floating docks had been removed and that work on replacing the docks had begun. Staff then performed a site visit and confirmed that 8 of the original 12 docks had been removed and that 4 docks with approximately 60 exposed pilings remained in the bed of the river. As part of the application, staff required a repair plan detailing how and when the marina would be reconstructed and restored. Throughout 2009 and up until last month, staff repeatedly sent letters and made calls to both Mr. Sorensen and his manager requesting that they submit a complete application, submit a repair plan for the marina, provide the minimum expense deposit to cover the application costs, and pay the rent that had been accruing since August 1, 2009. Mr. Sorensen did not respond. On July 14, 2010, Mr. Sorensen was sent formal notice of the staff's intent to recommend termination of the holdover tenancy and denial of the application for the Commission's consideration at this meeting. Mr. Sorensen responded and met with staff on July 27th to discuss his ability to pay the outstanding rent, provide the funds necessary to cover staff costs to process an application, and maintain a lease in the lease premises. Mr. Sorensen stated that he has met with personal financial difficulties and that the marina is subject to economic obstacles due to its remote location and the current levee repair work taking place along Garden Highway. He assured staff that he is committed to providing the processing fees, the rent, and outstanding information and wants to move forward with the new lease and continue repairs to improve the marina facilities. On August 5, 2010, after this meeting agenda was finalized, staff performed a site visit, and the photos you are seeing today were taken at that visit. While at the site, Mr. Sorensen's manager provided staff with a check for $2,500 toward the processing the application, and as late as this week, Mr. Sorensen's manager provided an additional $500. The $3,000 has now been applied toward the outstanding staff costs incurred during the past 2 years. In conclusion, because of the circumstances that have occurred over the past 10 years, staff is recommending that the Commission, one, authorize staff to terminate the month-to-month tenancy of a general lease, commercial use, lease number PRC 4485.1. If the applicant fails within 60 days to complete the lease application process, including the submission of an application processing fees, submission of a deteriorated repair plan, and payment of accrued back rent plus penalty and interest, and two, authorize staff of the State Lands Commission and the Office of the Attorney General to take all steps necessary, including litigation, to eject Richard Sorensen, to seek removal of all improvements from sovereign land in the bed of the Sacramento River, to restore the sovereign lands at this location to their condition prior to the placement of the improvements, and to recover the Commission's damages and costs, including unpaid back rent, penalty and interest upon failure of their applicant to comply with the conditions authorized in paragraph one above. Staff's available to answer any questions.
Thank you. Comments from commissioners? Comments from the public? I don't have any speaker cards here. Do we have a motion? We have a motion and a second. All in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Staff approval, staff recommendation is approved. The next item, Paul, where are we? Are we going, circling back to?
Probably 55. 54 has been taken off, right, although it'll be subject to public comment during the public comment period, but we still have 55 remaining.
Okay, so item 55. Mario, hi.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Commissioners. My name is Mario DiBernardo. I'm the legislative liaison for the State Lands Commission. Well, as you well know, Washington, D.C. has been very busy with the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. There are at least 10 major investigations occurring by the federal government, at least on Capitol Hill, at least 47 bills addressing oil spill, and there are several discussion drafts that are being discussed and possibly introduced. This resolution supports several key provisions in these bills. These provisions repeal or increase the cap of liability on oil spills, impose stronger standards and technology for oil spill response and prevention, including standards and technology requirements for blowout preventers, mandates worst-case scenario planning for oil spills, calls for monthly inspections of offshore facilities with an increase in inspections if there are safety violations found, regulation of the chemical dispersants used in oil spills, protection for whistleblowers, and improvement of federal agencies' roles in oil spill prevention and response, including an increase in training and response with the Coast Guard, EPA, and the successor of MMS. This resolution supports all of these key provisions. It also supports or urges Congress and the President to support a permanent ban on offshore oil leasing or new offshore oil leasing off the California coast. The Commission in the last decade, as well as the Governor, has strongly pursued this with the federal government. This resolution would reiterate that position once again. Thank you.
To add, if I may, to what Mario said, we see this as kind of a bookend to the staff report on the state programs that obviously, as has been testified, as the Lieutenant Governor referred to, there are 27 offshore oil platforms offshore California. And we only have four of them in state waters. The rest of them are in federal waters. So we could do all the work in the world in improving our state program, but the risk is still, at least in a quantity perspective, from the federal waters. We can't regulate that, but we think some of the measures that are being proposed in Congress are worthy of support for attempting to improve that situation. We didn't try and go through on a bill-by-bill basis picking bills that should be supported. A lot of that's changing. Instead, it seemed more sense to pick out the kinds of policy improvements and program improvements that made the more sense, the most sense, and then have the commission take a stance on those. Again, this resolution was something that was proposed by the controller's office.
I would add that it's likely that several of these proposals, which are in separate bills now, will be consolidated into more comprehensive bills. And so, as Paul said, that's the reason why we didn't go with specific bills, but went with general concepts, so that if those bills are combined into bigger pieces of legislation, that we can send a support letter.
Thank you, Mario. Thank you,
Madam Chair, on a procedural point,
yes.
Before the commission can vote on this, I have to let them know that we have two alternates now to the constitutional officers. Only one is allowed, so only one of you can participate and vote on the matter. That this does not apply to the Director of Finance's office.
Thank you, Curtis. That's a good point. May I have a motion? Okay, it's... Curtis can explain the rule.
Yes, Lieutenant Governor is absent, and so Amanda Fulkerson is taking his place, and so.
Can I do that? Okay, moving on. I'm sorry. I'm not paying attention. I'm only paying attention to staff. I just want to double check in light of my earlier comments that the eight things that we're asking to do. Suggesting the federal government do is that those are all things that we currently do on our own California platforms.
They're either things that we already do or are encompassed in the recommendations we included in our prior report, and we did that. We kind of did a cross check to make sure we're being consistent.
Okay, and then just in the final resolved about permanently banning offshore oil, I think we're all talking about new offshore oil and new gas leases. It doesn't say that. It almost implies that we were suggesting that they cease immediately, which maybe...
Well, and it makes reference not to the leases but the sales. So we're saying ban sales, and there's...
Okay.
You know, that's what makes lease. If you're more comfortable, we
with
can
the
introduce
word
the word new.
Yeah, that'd be that. Good. I mean, and then I'll move approval.
Okay.
Sure.
We'll put that in after new or after ban.
Okay. Then I move approval. Thank you.
And I'll second the motion, and it carries unanimously with one not participating pursuant to law. I think I'm participating.
Okay.
I'm going to participate. Amanda's okay with participating.
Yes. Thanks. So that completes our regular calendar, and now, as the chair was alluding to, we could, if the commission agrees, circle back to consent item 25, where, again, we had thought there was no opposition to this, but have received a notification that Mr. Wes Moody, who is associated with the Agate Pier Swim Club, objects to the rent review that the staff had recommended that the commission adopt. I believe the staff recommendation will be presented by Mary Hayes from our Land Management Division.
Thank you.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm going to give you just a quick summary of calendar item 24. My name is Mary Hayes. I'm with the state with the Land Management Division, and I'm a public land manager. Calendar item 25 is regarding a revision of rent for an existing lease at Lake Tahoe. Our lessee is Agate Pier and Swim Club Incorporated, and they're located at 5690 North Lake Boulevard in Agate Bay, which is in Placer County at Lake Tahoe. Agate Bay Pier and Swim Club is a private club, and they have on state sovereign lands an existing pier, 21 mooring buoys, and one marker buoy. The lease was approved by the commission in December 16th of 1998, and at that time the rent was set a minimum rent with a percentage of gross, because it was our understanding that they were also renting their 21 buoys to their members. So the rent was based at that time on an existing benchmark that we had at Lake Tahoe. It was an appraisal that is applied within the bed of Lake Tahoe for recreational and commercial. We have a commercial and a recreational type leases there. Pursuant to the terms of the lease, the The commission reviews the rent every 5 years. Just as a little background, in 2007, we did a new benchmark. The prior benchmark had been set in 1992. There have been many years in between. We did update it in 2007, so there was a significant increase in rents at Lake Tahoe. Just to give you a little background, the rent for the use of state lands for a single-use buoy went from $93 a year to $340 a year. And the rent per square foot for recreational and commercial use went from 21 cents a square foot to 80 cents a square foot. So there's a significant jump in rent. Pursuant to the terms of the lease, we're bringing this item to the commission to increase the rent beginning July 1st of 2010. And we are requesting that the commission approve the revision of the minimum rent for the lease PRC 3994.1 from $3,220 a year to $11,720 a year, effective July 1st of this year.
Thank you,
and
Mary.
We're available for any more questions.
Thank you. We have a speaker card from Wes Moody.
Good morning. Good morning. My name is Wes Moody. I'd like to thank the commission for hearing me on this important matter to my community. I'm a volunteer director, one of several, for the Agate Pier and Swim Club. We're a 501c7 nonprofit organization. We're effectively a community service entity, and we're doing our best to provide vacation and recreational opportunities for a small community in North Lake Tahoe. The agenda item C25 is staff's recommendation to increase the lease fee on an annual basis. You just heard from staff on that. The increase, again, is from $3,220 per year to a little over $11,700 per year. That's a 264% increase in a single year. We have twice written to the staff over the course of the last year seeking a more moderate increase. Our first proposal was to increase it from the $3,220 per year to a little more than $5,000 a year, which would itself be a 57% increase in a single year. When staff advised us of the benchmark study they had done in 2007, we compiled some information about the real estate price declines in the Tahoe area since 2007. And on that basis, we revised our requested lease terms from the original $3,220 up to $8,204, which is, again, itself a 155% increase in a single year compared to the 264% increase that staff was recommending. Both of our offers have been rejected by the staff, and most recently their offer was to simply delay the effectiveness of the 264% increase. But if I understand staff this morning, that offer is not on the table. If I understood correctly, the recommendation this morning is the increase be effective on July 1st, 2010. By way of background, and it's been a long morning, so I'll try to be as brief as possible. In the early 1950s, a man by the name of Buzz Davis bought property between on the North Shore of Tahoe, between what is today Carnelian Bay and Kings Beach, and subdivided that property for residential vacation use for the most part, and had the vision of providing vacation and recreational opportunities for what amounts to working class people. These are not waterfront homes. These are not estates. These are relatively small lots where, as I mentioned, working class people can provide a vacation opportunity for their family. Buzz had the vision of creating something good for families and particularly children. And in the early years, Buzz would bring burros and livestock ponies to the area and give kids pony rides. A pool was constructed, came up with a bunch of goofy games that were geared toward the children that we continue today, penny dives in the pool and opportunity to guess how many pieces of candy are in a jar and win the jar of candy. We have a 4th of July parade where one of the members of the community has a truck with a PA system, and we play patriotic music as we drive the truck around the neighborhood, and all the kids in the neighborhood have their bikes decorated with red, white, and blue, and come back to the pool and have a barbecue. Pledge of Allegiance. It's a little slice of Americana. It's in some ways a look back in time, but it's intended for the families there in Agate Bay. It's very clear we are not a homeowners association because when Buzz Davis, the original developer, grew ill and decided to attempt to sell the amenities to the community, it was offered to all members of the community, but only a fraction of the residents in the community decided to opt into the purchase of the pier and the pool. But we still represent 238 families in the area and provide this pier and buoy that's the subject of the staff's recommendation for use by those 238 family members as well as guests that they have or, in some cases, renters. We've, as I mentioned, tried to stay true to the spirit of Buzz's original vision for the area. It's, again, it's kind of a throwback to an earlier era. We're not a homeowners association, but we're also not a commercial venture. We simply collect dues from our member families in an effort to recover the cost. Again, we're a nonprofit organization. Over the course of the past 5 years, notwithstanding the benchmarking that the staff has referred to, we've increased our buoy fees to our members about 9% a year, and our revenues to the club, again, nonprofit organization, we've been losing a little bit of money, but our revenues have been increasing at about 6% as a result of the rental fees. Those are pretty typical increases, I believe, under the circumstances. And our club, this group, this community, cannot withstand an increase that the staff is recommending. This 264% increase in a single year, even if it was spread over a couple of years, is just totally untenable to us. So I would respectfully request that the commission consider some more reasonable increase than what has been recommended by the staff.
Thank you, Mr. Moody, for the presentation. What's the pleasure of the commission? Any comments?
Staff comment on that a little bit. It is a dramatic rent increase, but albeit we've been getting criticized for not getting good rent, so it's catch 22 here.
Well, and I think I would say that if anything, that probably the rent had been too low before, that when it was originally set, it was several years after the earlier benchmark had been set. So the association's been, or the club has been enjoying kind of below market rents, and so the shock is harder. We ran into the exact same thing on the marine oil terminals that the senator was concerned about, where we had 65-year-old leases with no opportunity to change them, and we ended up, in one case, multiplying the marine oil terminal rent by 40 times to bring it current, which was one of the reasons it was difficult. So our approach has been it's best to set market rent at this point. We're going to avoid that way having large rent increases in the future if we set them at the right rate now. This is the same rate we're using everywhere else. If I don't know how they prorate the cost of the buoys, whether the person who enjoys the buoy pays for it or whether it's paid for by the entire association. It's obviously about $500 a year for the if the rent were imposed on the buoy holders, it's about $50 a year per family if it were distributed over the whole thing. But regardless of that, we don't charge corporations or people who have a lot of money more money to use the state property or less money. We just we crank in the appraised value and try and get the fair market rent without other regard. We do have the ability to charge less or no rent if there's a public benefit. But again, although this may be a community in the sense that everybody knows each other and has parades and that sort of thing, it's also a private membership club that some elect to belong to and others don't. And so it's not equivalent to a town facility or anything like that. So given all of that, we think we've set the rent at the rate that our appraisal from back in 1997 indicated was the appropriate benchmark, and it's consistent with what we're doing in other places in Tahoe.
Thank you. It looks like Mr. Moody wants to make a quick point.
If I could just make two quick points. Number one, I'm under the understanding that the State Lands Commission does offer a different lease fee for homeowners association, and although we are not a homeowners association in many respects in this regard, we're very like a homeowners association, much more like homeowners association than we are a business that's trying to make money on buoy rental. Second point I'd like to make is what business, or for that matter what government, would neglect to make periodic assessments or reappraisals of cost and then expect it to be reasonable to recover all of that in a single year? That's just not a reasonable practice in my judgment.
Well, I want to be clear. We're not recovering past rents where the rate might have been higher in the past. We're only setting a rent for the go-forward, not trying to make up for lost time. This is the rent that we would have charged if they were paying $10,000 a year prior to this. So we're not trying to recover. We're trying to get to the market rate.
Okay, and I think there was a question that probably relates to the fact that homes owned by the upland owner, I'll let Curtis chime in and explain.
The legislature has prohibited the commission from charging rents for homeowners who have piers or buoys out in the lake if they are the upland owner and they have a residence on that, and that is applied to homeowners associations on a percentage basis as well. I think there's something on the calendar, in fact, in that regard. So when you are not a homeowners association or a individual upland owner, then the commission is required to charge a fair market rent, and that's what we're doing here.
Thank you.
May I ask one more question?
Sure.
Would you please reiterate, you said there was an agreement or an offer, two offers that you guys had made with this, or he, I'm sorry, he said that.
Those offers were rejected? Those were offers from our association.
They were offers from your association to the State Lands Commission?
Correct, written offers.
That's right.
What were the offers?
One was what, $5,000, the other one was $8,000
approximately. The first one was $5,048 per year, and the second one was $8,204 per year.
And what did you base that on?
The first one was, I'm sorry, I can't remember what the basis for the first one was. I believe it was a percentage increase based on the prior period of time. But I can't be sure about that. But for sure the second one was based. We had heard in the meantime from the staff that they had done this 2007 benchmarking study, and so the second offer was based on what we believe to be the decline in values since January 1st, 2007, and that's how we arrived at the $8,204.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and Mr. Moody, I'm just going to point out something that you may not be aware of. It was during the executive officer's report, Paul talked about this, but the timing of your request is simultaneous with the Joint Legislative Audit Committee's
decision to examine the State Lands Commission to make sure that the State Lands Commission is receiving market rate rents for all of its properties. And so that's just a timing issue, and I think it's in everyone's mind. So I'm just going to inform you of it because I know you don't probably follow our all of our goings on as carefully as we do.
As long as we're talking about coincidences in time, this also occurs at a time when the TRPA has imposed upon all buoy owners in the basin enormous increases in fees. So it's breaking the back of our community association.
We understand.
And I want to make sure the record is clear that the rent that we're proposing be adopted for this was set before Senator Cogdill's letter was issued. So the staff was not influenced by that in making this proposal.
I was just pointing out so that Mr. Moody, it seems like it's come up, but I didn't know if Mr. Moody was aware of it, so I thought I would just let him know. Okay. Pleasure.
I'll move approval of the staff recommendation.
And I'll second. And so it's adopted 2 with 1 not participating.
That concludes the regular calendar, and we would move to public comment.
We have a number of speaker cards for public comment. So I'm informed that our timer may be malfunctioning. Okay, it may be functioning. There are 3 minutes for each person who makes public comment, and if you could get I will call the names out 3 in a row. Just please get ready so that you can approach the podium without walking all the way from your seat. We're going to start with Marty Adams, followed by Catherine Stone, followed by J. Roger Myers.
Good afternoon. Marty Adams from Department of Water and Power in Los Angeles. I don't have an item on the agenda this time for a change, but I promised that I would give you a report every meeting, and so I intend to do it real quickly. Just to let you know, the master plan for Owens Lake is proceeding very well. I would like to thank Paul Thayer and his staff, Colin Connor, and Marina Rand have been involved with the process. Paul's made them available. They make a 2-day trip going to Owens Valley every month to participate very actively in the master plan. And we expect to have a draft plan out by the end of the calendar year. So we're looking real good on that. And we do think we have agreement across the board that it is the way ahead for the lake. And item 44 in your consent agenda for the EIR consultant was in conjunction with the master plan. So we're happy to see that move ahead. Last meeting in June, you did award us a lease for tillage on the areas that Great Basin Air Pollution Control District found suitable on the lake, the Phase 7 areas. Yesterday, I was at the lake. We have done test tillage areas in all the Phase 7 areas. On Monday, they'll be evaluating it with our scientists and Great Basin to find out which areas we believe are suitable. And so hopefully we'll have some significant interim dust controls in the Phase 7 areas to help with the dust season coming ahead. As far as what we see in the future, in terms of compliance, we do know that October 1st, we will be technically out of compliance with the state implementation plan. We believe that the correct path ahead, because there is an exposure to fines for the city of LA, is that we'll be entering into probably a stipulated order of abatement for dust control. That order will address controls for Phase 7 in lieu of the boat and row not moving ahead, and something that's permanent that meets the requirements of the Great Basin, and also controls for Phase 8, Phase 9, and potentially Phase 10 as well. Recently, we put out a mitigated negative deck for a gravel project on 2 square miles of Phase 8. Staff has given us comments, and we are responding to comments at this time. We believed we had some time to work with staff on trying to find a way to make that work out. Yesterday we had a meeting with the Great Basin, and it looks like in order to work on our stipulated order, we're going to have to try to move that ahead to get that in front of the board so we have a response to a gravel project so we can know whether that can be included in our stipulated order or not. So that's kind of where we stand in a nutshell. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Marty.
Thank you.
We have Catherine Stone, followed by J. Roger Myers, followed by David Johnston.
My name is Catherine Stone, and 5 of the people who signed cards are not going to speak. They're going to yield their time to me, although I won't take it all. Those are David Johnston, who's president of the Seacliff Beach Homeowners Association, Pat McDonald, who is the vice president of the HOA, Ted McDonald, who's a member of the HOA, and J. Roger Myers, a trial attorney. I am also an attorney for the Homeowners Association. I mailed you the letters with the exhibits, express mail yesterday, Wednesday, and I provided you with copies today, and I hope you will take a look at them. And I understand we may be back before you in October if we can come to some kind of an agreement with staff. I want to thank the Lieutenant Governor's office and very much for all the efforts they have made to try to resolve this issue. It involves the repair of a revetment that protects 49 homes at Seacliff Beach. We've been trying to get it repaired for 4 years through the various approvals, when we finally got Coastal Commission approval 2 years ago. We took a proposed compromise to the association on Sunday, but they did not approve it. And that's because they believe that the revetment was built on private property, and so does Caltrans, who actually built it in 1972 as mitigation for the highway that goes out over the ocean now. And the highway project, including the revetment, was before the State Lands Commission in 1970. Exhibit 1 to the packet is the transcript of that hearing. And the Caltrans engineer testified that the revetment had been designed by their expert and was part of the project. And Caltrans attorneys and staff have stated emphatically that they built it on private property. There was a lawsuit for damages, and a settlement was reached in 1977, which repeatedly emphasizes that the revetment was built on private property. And it refers to the right to repair the revetment, the landowner's right to repair it. We have proposed a boundary line agreement at the design toe of the revetment. That location, the design toe of the revetment, has been approved by the Coastal Commission. It's under the sand, of course. Exhibit 15 shows the design toe of the revetment and the 1953 ordinary high watermark. The compromise would be to pull in that 1953 ordinary high watermark and pull out a small portion in front of 10 or 12 lots. We are eager and willing to pay all of staff's costs, past and future, and a boundary line assessment fee, a reasonable fee. Staff has now indicated a willingness to consider a boundary line agreement just today, or yesterday I got a letter, and to put it on the October calendar. So we respectfully request that you ask staff to follow through with this. If we don't get the revetment repaired this year, and there are heavy storms, there may be serious damage. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Apart from the people that Ms. Stone mentioned, I don't have any other speaker cards. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak during public comment?
I would just say that we believe that we've received
in the equivalent of an application, a proposal for this boundary line agreement. Our intent is to analyze that and bring it back to the commission at its next meeting. And so rather than get into a long discussion of all the issues today, it would make more sense to do it then. But we'll analyze that proposal. And as I think the commissioners realize and the association would agree, we've met several times in an attempt to work out our issues with the association. We expect that we'll have more of those meetings and that we'll bring back the results either in terms of an agreement that we support or an analysis in any event of the proposed boundary line agreement with a staff recommendation at that on that. And we hope to be able to do that at the next meeting, which is not yet scheduled, but we would anticipate being in October.
Thank you. Okay, well, that concludes the regular calendar. Seeing no other members of the public that wish to address the commission, are we going to have a closed session?
I don't believe it's necessary at this point.
Okay, thank you. The meeting is adjourned.